Hello, and welcome to Unscripted, Conversations about Sexual and Domestic Violence, a podcast featuring employees and subject matter experts from domestic and sexual violence services and partner organizations discussing all aspects of interpersonal violence while providing prevention strategies, solutions, and resources for support for residents of Fairfax County. I'm your host, Kendra Lee. On this episode of Unscripted, I'm with Prevention and Education Coordinator Abby Picard and Domestic and Sexual Violence Counselor Lorena Hunter, both with Domestic and Sexual Violence Services, to talk about the ways control is used to further domestic violence. Abby, Lorena, welcome to Unscripted and thanks for being on the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Guys, thank you for having me.
Before we start, I want to let our listeners know if any part of today's conversation triggers strong emotions, please call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. One of the misunderstandings we have about domestic violence is that violent behavior happens because the person causing harm is stressed, angry, or influenced by external factors like drugs or alcohol. While those might exacerbate a problem, at its core, domestic violence is about power and control. The person causing harm tries to dominate their partner and maintain authority through a range of behaviors and tactics. So, Abby, get us started. Let's talk about some of the examples of controlling behaviors, especially ones that we might not think of as controlling behaviors.
Yeah. So one of the things that I think is important for folks to understand is that domestic violence happens over the context of a relationship, right? It's not that each individual time there's an act of violence, they're separate. One of the things that's really specifically relevant to domestic violence versus other forms of violence, like you said, Kendra, is about power and control. So behaviors that involve power and control in a relationship can include things like physical violence or threat of physical violence. Those are the ones that folks tend to think of when they hear that phrase, domestic violence. Mm-hmm. But they can also include behaviors that are trying to stalk someone's partner. So tracking their location, trying to understand where they are at all times. This used to be more low tech, just like asking someone to call you when they get someplace. But now you can literally track someone, right? Could also be things like controlling the people that you're allowed to talk to, isolating someone from friends and family, not allowing them to work or have an education, which impacts them financially as well as emotionally. But all of those things together can lead to an environment of that power and control over the person experiencing violence. So if I've experienced different forms of violence from you in the past, it can start to become that new normal. And the control is the expectation that as a person experiencing violence from my partner, I am not able to make decisions for myself. I might be questioning the decisions I do make, and I'm constantly feeling that control of what are the things that are going to set my partner off and make me less safe. And so it's that combination of behaviors and then also that context in a relationship that really expresses domestic violence.
What about if I take medicine or if I need to see the doctor and my partner prevents me from taking the medicine I need or prevents me from seeking medical treatment? Is that also control?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are forms of physical violence that we don't always think of as physical, but not allowing someone access to healthcare, to their mobility aids, like a wheelchair or cane, not giving them access to their medications, and also physical isolation, not allowing them to leave the house or keeping them from leaving a room while an argument is going on, that kind of thing, are absolutely forms of control as well.
Okay. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a difference between an unhealthy relationship where both partners still share power, even if the relationship is dysfunctional, and ones where domestic violence is present, right?
I'll put that to Lorena, but I will say yes. The answer is yes, right? Unhealthy behaviors and actions can happen in any of our relationships, but there are differences that, you know, Lorena can probably speak to between an unhealthy relationship and an abusive relationship involved in that power and control.
Yes, Lorena, go ahead and explain this difference for us.
Yes. So most definitely. The thing that I would say, you know, when I meet with my clients is, you know, of course, right, they may come in and be like, you know, we just have a little toxic relationship, you know, sometimes like that. But the thing about healthy and unhealthy relationships is, especially when you are, you know, in a domestic violence relationship or domestic violence is present in the relationship, is that aspect of there is someone who has more power and control over the other individual, right? So when we look at healthy relationships, we look at, you know, respect, right? That, mm-hmm. you know, they both respect each other. You know, they're both able to make the decisions, right? There's an equal share of, you know, responsibilities or, you know, equal share of decision-making within the relationship versus in those domestic violence relationships, it's one person, you know, controlling and having that power with someone. And also in addition, there may be the presence of physical violence, sexual violence, intimidation, threats, all of those things in those relationships.
Another thing I'll share about that unhealthy versus abusive is fear of leaving because of that fear of retaliation is also something that's incredibly relevant as to whether something is unhealthy or unsafe, right? Mm-hmm. What's going to happen? What kind of retaliation may I face if I try to make those decisions, right? Not just we're going to be in an argument, but am I going to be in fear if I do try to make a decision without my partner being the one in control of that decision?
Yeah, that's a good point, Abby.
So domestic violence seems to be a pattern of behaviors, not necessarily an isolated violent event. Let's talk about that. Abby, let me let you take a stab at it first.
Yeah, so it's that pattern of behaviors. So there's actually some scholarship and research that talks about different kinds of domestic violence. And there are forms of domestic violence that really are looking at a one-time incident. But the majority of people that we see at domestic and sexual violence services and the majority of people who are really identified in that way are folks who are seeing that pattern of behavior, right? If there's an unhealthy relationship, there's an incident of physical violence, and then that is the end of the relationship, or someone breaks up with a partner and then that partner is violent towards them, that doesn't necessarily mean that there was that presence of domestic violence that is much more frequent and more commonly what we're seeing with clients who are seeking our services. Domestic violence in the context of understanding power and control is that pattern of behaviors. And so a pattern doesn't necessarily need to be that something is happening in every single day or something is happening at the same time over and over again. But it is the matter of the cycle, what we sometimes call the cycle of violence, right? So a huge incident of violence happens, and that can be physical violence, but that can also just be a huge argument where everybody left feeling unsafe after that argument, right? Then mm-hmm. there's this phase of justification or affection, right? So sometimes it's called the hearts and flowers phase, or love bombing is a term that we hear a lot on TikTok now, but love bombing mm-hmm. came from domestic violence research of making someone all of the apologies and excuses of, you know, I'm only like that if, I'm so sorry, I'll never do that again, right? That phase. And then the third phase, it moves into sort of a same old duck for a little while, but mm-hmm. then the tension begins to build. And the tension builds and builds and builds until there's that additional incident of violence. And then we circle around, right? So that pattern is something that's pretty frequently seen in relationships with power and control. Because if a person was only experiencing every single day, all the time, violence, 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 there are situations where that person may be able to identify this is domestic violence, right? And want to leave that relationship. But it can be really difficult for people mentally and emotionally if there are a lot of really good times in the relationship and my partner is really apologetic and I believe and I hope and I want to believe that this person who I love and who loves me is not going to treat me like that again. And that was the outlier. But that's the pattern that we often see, is that it's coming back around. Lorena, definitely add anything I missed.
Yeah, no, I think you hit the nail on the coffin. Those patterns. You know, something, Abby, that you just mentioned about, the partner saying, like, you know, they have all these good qualities within them, you know, and I want to say, and something that I, you know, share with my clients or as an exercise that I happen to do in our sessions is, okay, I want you to list all the good and all the bad, right? And I want you to, you know, kind of weigh each thing of, you know, if you see these good things, right, for every good thing that may have happened, right? You know, but also the bad, right? And the bad sometimes is really bad. Like, you know, they've choked them. They've, you know, presence of physical violence, almost, you know, sometimes near death. And it's just like, okay, so kind of weighing, like, you know, your life at that point in survival.
Yeah. And another thing that I think is important to understand with patterns is that it can be easy to look at someone outside of that relationship and see the pattern in a way that can be hard for them to see within it. Right. Yeah. We can see, hey, this keeps happening over and over again. But the norm for that person, and if it's something that they are seeing on their day to day, it can be easy to sort of descend it to other people, and people can get defensive because they think, like, you're not seeing the whole relationship, which is true of any relationship, any intimate relationship. The people in it know much more about their partner and about the relationship than the people outside of it. But it's important if someone that you know and someone that you love is experiencing domestic violence to realize that even if you recognize these patterns, it can be a lot more difficult for them too. And so I just want to make sure that we're clear as well that that's difficult to do. And that's one of the times where reaching out to someone with domestic and sexual violence services can be really helpful. Because folks like Lorena on our clinical team, as well as our advocates in our hotline, can help people identify those things and see those things in a way that they not might not be seeing for themselves.
That's true. This seems like a good time to take a quick pause to remind our listeners that if any part of today's conversation triggers them, they can call the Domestic and Sexual 24-Hour Hotline at 703-360-7273, where they can get in touch with our trained advocates who can help them through a problem like this. So abuse seems to have a hierarchy where physical violence is considered top tier, for lack of a better term, abuse. It has visible signs. People recognize it as abuse. And then there's emotional, which often leaves no outward signs. So it's considered a lower form of abuse, even if sometimes not even considered abuse. How does this hierarchy cause survivors to doubt their experiences or delay reaching out for help?
Yeah, I guess I'll go first. So, you know, many times I may have seen, like, with clients is they really doubt and question, like, is this even abuse? Because they may come and say, like, hey, you know, they've never hit me. They've never, you know, I've never experienced that. But, you know, they, you know, talk down to me. You know, they, you know, have controlling behavior, things of that nature. So, and I will also say sometimes it's hard for them to kind of identify those patterns that aren't, you know, likely just outward out there. And so it, you know, it doubts, and then, you know, they end up staying in the relationship for years, right? Because they've questioned themselves and, you know, questioned, you know, even if it is abuse, and also, you know, with the partner who has, you know, who is causing the harm, has also kind of diminished their feelings or, you know, invalidated how they feel or what they're experiencing, because they are the ones that's causing the harm. So I think it, you know, it really comes to self-doubt, and what I've seen also, like, can also deal with that low self-esteem of, you know, of not really, you know, of just really being down on themselves and questioning themselves a lot.
Yeah, I also think something to think about is, you know, physical violence, like you said, Kendra, can be seen as visible. It's not always visible. Mm-hmm. And also, it's not always the thing that has the biggest impact on a person's life. If someone is physically harmed by their partner one time and they go to the emergency room, obviously that's unacceptable and it's a part of the violence. But if that same person has absolutely no access to their finances, their medications, their immigration paperwork, there are so many things that allow a person to control someone else that actually you're going to have that significant impact in that way. A statistic that I share a lot when I train is that there is research that shows that 97% of relationships with domestic violence involve some form of financial abuse or financial control. And that's huge. And a lot of people don't know that until after they've left the relationship and they look into their finances and they find out what their partner has been hiding from them, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, physical violence is not only not sort of the top of the hierarchy, it's also often not the thing that is the most significant. I will say this has been true for most of my career. I have never met an advocate or someone who works in domestic violence who has been in the field for over a year or two who doesn't have a story of someone who was severely physically harmed and told them that the emotional abuse has worked. It hurt worse. It was the worst thing. It's incredibly common to hear that from survivors because that's something that's inside your brain all the time. You can't get away from that by going into a different room, by going into a different house, by going to the hospital. That's something that really breaks down their self-esteem. And yeah, like I said, even people who do experience that significant physical violence often say the emotional and mental abuse has had a more significant impact on their life.
I said in my opener that external factors like alcohol or substance abuse are not the root cause of domestic violence. If the need to control your partner is the root cause, how do we address that? How do we fix that?
I think, honestly, the first step is awareness. You know, kind of how, you know, earlier it was mentioned about, you know, not even kind of identifying the patterns of domestic violence and or in controlling behavior. I think the first thing to do is kind of identify it, you know, and that comes with psychoeducation of, mm-hmm. you know, of the patterns, right? Of recognizing, like, you know, kind of like Abby mentioned about, you know, financial abuse and all these other factors that may be happening, these other patterns that may be happening in the relationship. So I think the first thing is, you know, awareness, being aware of it. I think, you know, with that, also with the awareness, right, of, okay, once I become aware of it, it's like, you know, of course, too, right, we got to think about safety, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's just like, okay, you know, how can I keep myself safe, right, within, mm-hmm. within, you know, the relationship and, you know, but also navigating of taking that, you know, their own power back, in a sense. And I think with that is more leaning into the support systems that they have, you know, especially if there was some isolation going on, you mm-hmm. know, it's like really figuring out, like, okay, you know, and that with the help of, you know, of course, if they want to come to clinical services, or just advocates of just like really like, you know, safety planning and like also figuring out their support system and leaning more into them. With that, I think, those are kind of like the first steps, I would say, of how we can, you know, break away from that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would add to that as well that the responsibility of someone who is using violence against their partner to stop that violence is the person who is doing that violence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we can do so much to support people in being safe, whether or not they do decide they want to leave that relationship or mm-hmm. whether or not they decide they want to right now. Mm-hmm. But we also have to have opportunities for people to take accountability for their actions.
Yes.
If you're a longtime listener of the podcast, I'm sure you've heard of our ADAPT program, which works with folks who have used violence towards a partner or family member. And a really core component of that program is accountability and compassion for self and others, right? Being able to take accountability for one's actions, recognize the way that you've hurt someone else, and then do things to change that and do things to help in that healing process. But that is all fully the responsibility, and the only person who can actually solve that is the person who's using violence. So it's our responsibility as people who work in this field and as communities to hold people accountable and support them.
Yeah.
Because the person who is experiencing the violence from them cannot do that. They literally cannot, right? They're the person experiencing control. Of course, they can't be the one to fix it. And so it's important for us as communities and as people whose loved ones may be experiencing violence or whose loved ones may be causing harm in their relationship to hold people accountable in that way. And that can look like identifying those behaviors and having a conversation with someone, you know. A lot of times when we're asked this question of, you know, what do we do this? How do we fix this? People sort of see like survivors and people causing harm as two completely distinct groups. That's absolutely not the case. We know for a fact that it is incredibly common for people who are using violence in their relationship to have experienced violence in their childhood or as an adult. That does not excuse the behavior. But if you're a friend or family member of that person, you can bring that up to them, right? You know, where is this coming from? It doesn't sound like it's coming from your spouse. It sounds like maybe related to something you've experienced in your life. Or even things like when I talk to young people, like college students who are worried about a friend, saying things like, I don't think it's okay for you to talk to your girlfriend like that or your boyfriend like that. Or that was really unkind. Have you apologized? Right. And when we do see those things, especially for young people, but also for adults, being able to call them out, like being someone's mom or auntie or uncle or dad, your words are going to have so much greater of an impact than, you know, an advocate, right? Especially if you're feeling like you're being blamed and that's why I have to talk to this advocate, right? Versus someone saying, hey, I don't like that. And I know that you're a better person than that. And I don't think it's kind or okay for you to treat your partner in that way.
Yeah. So ideally, addressing the root cause of violence would end the cycle of violence, ideally. But this is probably not true since we still have violence and we are doing the, especially in Fairfax County, the adapt part where we work with people causing harm as well as working with the survivors. So why is addressing the root cause not ending the problem, not interrupting the cycle? That's the million-dollar question, right, Abby?
Well, the other part of the root cause is just the level of trauma in the general population. When you experience something difficult as a child, which many, many, many people do, whether it's domestic or sexual violence or something else, if you're not able to build those skills in emotional regulation, that often puts people on a path to not be able to be healthy in their relationships. And most people don't start abusive, right? Unhealthy comes first. They're different, but unhealthy comes first. And so, you know, we need to be able to identify, and this will definitely pass to Lorena, but, you know, how are we supporting people in addressing trauma earlier in their lives? And how are we keeping emotional regulation and that compassion for self and others before people are in those romantic relationships? Because if I feel out of control, that's a situation where I want to exert control. There are healthy ways to do that, and there are unhealthy ways to do that, and there are abusive ways to do that, which is when you try to do it toward another person, right?
Yes, I definitely agree. You know, there's a saying, hurt people hurt people, right? And so, you know, addressing, right, kind of what Abby was saying, of addressing, you know, if it, where that trauma started, if it's in childhood, right? They may have grown up, you know, and seen like, you know, or felt that maybe DV, you know, was normal or control was normal in a relationship because they saw their parents, right, going through it, or, you know, that that was shown, or, you know, them being abused themselves, right? And so I think to the core of that is, yes, of addressing the trauma, right, that they've experienced, to kind of unravel. It's layers, right? It's just like an onion. There's many layers. And so it's just like just pulling it back, right? And just like really processing it with them and, you know, exploring like, you know, well, why do you, you know, why do you think you do these things, right? What did you see, you know, growing up or whatever? And, you know, let's be honest. Sometimes people don't want to go there. People don't want to be like, I don't want to open up that wound, right? Because it's hard, you know. And but it's also right with us being, you know, trauma informed and things of that nature. Of, you know, helping the individual address those layers of trauma. And so I think that if we do that, right, that it could be a start. It could definitely be a start.
Yeah. And one thing I'll add is that, you know, the population of society is not good people and abusers, right? We all have tendencies to try to exert power and control over situations where we feel out of control. And we all cause harm in relationships in some way. You will not meet an adult who has not had to apologize for something they did in a relationship, whether that's a friendship, whether that's a family. Like, that's part of being human. The difference is that accountability piece, right? Mm-hmm. How people taking accountability, saying they're sorry, recognizing that they're the person at fault, because this is something that exists in all of us, and domestic violence is an extreme version of it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure that everyone listening to this podcast can think of a time where they hurt someone they loved with something they did or said, whether or not it was intentional. And then they were able to think about, you know what, I messed up. Let me go and apologize and talk to that person about what happened, right? Yeah. This is an extreme of that. It's not something completely separate. And so that's the other piece too, is giving people the tools to say they're sorry, take accountability, do things to repair that relationship for everyone, for all of us, is something that we can do before we're having to address things that have already happened and have been so harmful, as people are being physically harmed or controlled in these ways.
How do we safety plan for controlling behavior? What if you have been isolated from everybody you know and love, and it's been so long that you don't even know how to reach those people? How do we help someone safety plan when they've been controlled?
Well, first of all, give us a call. And that number is 703-360-7273. But the thing is, it's a hard question to answer because safety planning is so individualized.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We are not going to tell you, here's how to be safe. We're going to say, tell us what's going on with you. Let's talk about ways that you think would keep you safe.
Mm-hmm.
When there is a high level of power and control, it can be harder to reach out for help. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes the big piece that's different with that high power and control safety planning versus safety planning with someone who has a little bit more control over their situation is just identifying where can you go for help? Who can you reach out to for help? A lot of times people think it's no one. And then as you start to talk with them, it's, oh, you know what? My neighbor maybe might be helpful, or my child has a friend at school. Maybe I could talk to their parents, or I really trust my child's teacher, right? Or even just like I have a classmate, right, in my college class. So I think there's not one answer, but one thing is just really identifying where people do have strengths and supports, even if they're small.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be really empowering for them to identify those things and figure out for themselves, like, no, there are things that I'm doing to keep myself safe. So that's the sort of the base.
Okay. Any final thoughts that you want the audience to take away from this conversation? And I want both of you to respond to this. Lorena, we'll start with you.
Yes, I would just say, you know, with this, I would just say, I think that this is awesome, you know, that we are discussing this, because of many times, you know, when you're in these relationships, you don't recognize kind of the patterns and what's going on. And so I think, you know, something to take away with this is, you know, it's really, you know, when you're in this, if you're in a relationship like this, like, it's really not your fault.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but also, you know, that I want you to have hope of knowing that you can regain your power, self, and your power back, you know, and to really, you know, you can control yourself again, for lack of better words. Yes, I think those are my final thoughts.
I would just share that if you're someone who are concerned about your own relationship or a loved one, there's a tool called the Power and Control Wheel, which was developed in the 1980s and has continued to be iterated on, that lists different types of power and control in a relationship. You can literally Google Power and Control Wheel. And there are many organizations that have developed those for people with specific experiences and identities. So, for LGBTQ couples, for immigrants, for Muslim families, for deaf individuals. Those are just four off the top of my head that I remember what they look like. But if you look up Power and Control Wheel on your internet device, you can find resources to identify, you know, just what are some of the things that might be controlling behaviors. And if you see those things present, right? If you look at that and you still are concerned about your safety, but it's not the things on that wheel, it doesn't mean you're not experiencing violence or abuse, but it's often a really helpful way to sort of do a self-check-in for yourself, or if you're seeing things with a person that you care about. So I will leave with that as another resource people can check out.
Okay. That'll do it for this episode of Unscripted, Conversations about Sexual and Domestic Violence. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Abby and Lorena for joining us today. If you or someone you know has experienced interpersonal violence, call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. That's 703-360-7273. Or visit fairfaxcounty.gov and search for domestic and sexual violence. To listen to other Fairfax County government podcasts, visit www.fairfaxcounty.gov/podcasts. Unscripted, Conversations about Sexual and Domestic Violence, is produced by the Fairfax County, Virginia government.